While 5,000 men may seem like a small number, it must be remembered that these three islands are small themselves, so it would seem that the Japs have landed all the fighting men they could house. The other 5,000 of the enemy are on Japanese warships, warships prowling American waters in the Northwest Pacific for one of two reasons: to guard their operations on land, or to form the spearhead for a further invasion attempt. As far as the Navy knows, the Japs have not landed on the Pribilof Islands. The Navy sent some of its big planes winging over that desolate section to trace out the enemy. But it's not saying for certain that the Japs aren't there. All the Navy spokesman would say is this: we are not in a position to say that they're not there, but we have no evidence that they are. There is every indication that the Navy didn't issue its statement of its own accord. It looks as though the department felt called upon to sketch in a few details on the Alaskan front for the information of the general public. It appears that the Navy's hand was forced by Anthony J. Diamond, the delegate from Alaska in Congress. Diamond said he had received reports that the Japanese had up to 25,000 soldiers in Alaska and that they'd taken Pribilof. Operations in Alaska are taxing the supply lines of both the Americans and the Japanese. We have to take our food, fuel, and ammunition some 1,200 miles to that fighting front. The Japanese have to make a long sea trip of some 1,500 miles. So that brings us to the question of cargo planes. Donald Nelson, the war production boss, and Robert P. Patterson, he's Under Secretary of War, promised that Henry J. Kaiser will get a chance to prove his plan to build big flying boats in American shipyards. The two officials have only one if in giving Kaiser the green light. They'll go ahead with cargo planes if the cargo plane program will not take aircraft engines, steel, and aluminum away from the construction of bombing planes. Nelson says that bombing planes are our number one essential. At the same time, the government is combating an invasion attempt right here in the United States proper. J. Edgar Hoover and his FBI have uncovered a Japanese plot to recruit an undercover army of 100,000 Fifth Columnists. The plot's fantastic, but it's plausible, too. The army, according to FBI agents, has been organized during the last 10 years by powerful Japanese Black Dragon Society members. The idea was, even in the early 20s, to have an undercover army ready to strike America from within the moment that the Japanese realized their bloody and their vain dream of invading the United States. The Jap plot came to light with the arrest of a Filipino in New York. He's charged with helping to organize the army and promising that the Japanese would supply it with weapons. And the fate of the 8 German saboteurs appears to be sealed already. When the Supreme Court denied them a civil trial, it practically signed their death warrants. The decision of the military court on these spies, a decision expected to be death by the firing squad or death by hanging, is expected to be handed to Mr. Roosevelt before next week, and it may come before sundown today. Before long, we may all be in the Army or doing war work assigned us by the government. An administration source reveals that the manpower mobilization bill, now being drafted at the president's direction, would give him authority to draft workers as well as soldiers. The bill still is in its formative stage. It will be written, then submitted to Mr. Roosevelt, and, if he approves, sent to Congress. But you can bet this, there'll be no manpower mobilization before election. And that's all from Washington.
And now in our New York newsroom, we have a bulletin from Melbourne, Australia. The Japanese have extended their hold on the Solomon Islands east of New Guinea. They have established themselves on Guadalcanal Island, which is a suitable site for air bases. This disclosure is made in a communique from MacArthur's headquarters relating that Jap installations at Kukum on the north shore of the island were attacked yesterday by Allied planes. Flyers also damaged a big enemy cargo vessel offshore. Other bombers operating far to the northwest attacked and probably hit a Jap cruiser in the Banda Sea, south of Amboina in the Dutch East Indies. The land front on Big New Guinea Island is static today, but Allied warplanes have raided the Jap-occupied village of Buna in the Gona Mission area and started two large fires. A single enemy plane dropped one bomb yesterday a few miles from the village of Mossman on the northeastern Australian coast. However, damage was minor. And now our next report comes to us from the heart of the Middle East battle zone. We take you now to Cairo and the report of Grant Parr,
This is Ralph Carr speaking from Cairo, Egypt.
ACAC batteries woke Cairo sleepers with their rumble again last night. And those who bothered to get up and watch saw shells bursting in the moon-bathed skies like so many exploding stars. Flaming onions went up, too. Orange strings of round Chinese lanterns, they seemed. But from time to time, the roar of motors could be heard. Some were friendly, and some were not. One night fighter roaring over Cairo gave the recognition signal, a few flashes of light, as the searchlight spitted it for a moment in their beams. This morning, we assess the results of this second raid of the Cairo vicinity within 3 days. A small force of enemy bombers, probably a bit larger than the one Wednesday, were operating. At the same time, other Nazi bombers were over the Alexandria area. Of these two formations, British night fighters shot down three bombers. Around Cairo, several bombs were dropped. 5 persons were killed and 12 injured. Allied fighter bombers yesterday attacked what probably was the headquarters of a German panzer division. And whether or not they got any of the staff officers, they at least wrecked the mobile staff room. Fighting off a large force of Messerschmitt and Mackies as they fell, the British pilots flew to intense ACAC fire to land their explosives around a small group of trucks. One of the pilots said, "There wasn't much time to observe results of our bombing very closely. We were rather busy with the enemy fighters. But I guarantee that most of our bombs hit what they were intended to hit. At least 7 of them fell right among the vehicles. The top cover, that is the group of bombers flying the house, protected the first group of raiders as they dived in. Then, simply ignoring the Messerschmitt, they too went down. One pilot released his bomb while tracers from a German fighter were flickering across his wing. Nearby, 50 dispersed trucks were also raided. General Russell Maxwell of the United States Military Mission said here today that our big repair installation in Eritrea is beginning to show results. Wrecked planes, which were drifting in there a few weeks ago, are now flying again. Tribute to the completeness and efficiency of these plants, which are equipped to completely rebuild any airplane. Only the seemingly hopeless wrecks, which can't be salvaged by repair shops here, go to Eritrea. I now return you to New York."
And that was the report of Grant Parr, NBC's foreign correspondent in the heart of the Middle East battle zone at Cairo. For our next report, we take you once again overseas, this time to the British capital and the report of John McVane. We take you now to London.
Night smashed at Dusseldorf, the industrial center in the Rhineland region of Germany. The attack was carried out in good weather, and a very strong force of bombers took part. Attacks were also made on the aerodromes in the Low Countries and railroad objectives in France. 30 British bombers and 1 fighter are missing. Dusseldorf is a big steel center, the headquarters of the German steel cartel. It contains blast furnaces and armament factories, and round about are the villas of the big German iron and steel magnate. This year, the British are being urged to spend their vacations at home. Traveling is being discouraged, and papers have published a multitude of suggestions on how to get all the pleasures of a vacation in your own home. For instance, the other day, one writer listed all the most popular holiday areas of Britain, then explained that within easy subway ride of the center of London, the scenery and the joys of all these resorts can be almost exactly duplicated. There's fishing and boating, picnicking, and out-of-doors Shakespeare plays in the huge green London parks. And on any sunny weekend, Londoners flock to the parks, and it takes very little imagination to think that you're in the country. The theaters are doing a booming business. One explanation is that the people who spend their holidays at home are going to plays and films for relaxation. A theater man gave me another explanation yesterday. He said war workers are making a good deal of money, and because nearly everything is rationed, they can't spend their wages. He said that drinks and shows are the easiest way of spending money, and drink is difficult to get. This theater man explained that in peacetime, the box office clerk could tell by looking at a customer just about what price seat he was going to buy. Now, he said, a shabby-looking man who in other days would have bought pit seats for 50 or 75 cents would pull a wad of pounds from his pocket and buy the best seats in the house. Any weekend, you can see lines of people waiting for tickets on the sidewalks outside the big London movie houses. Musical shows and plays are playing to capacity audiences. Shakespeare plays are being shown in 3 different theaters. The general trend is toward comedy. However, the 2 latest plays to appear are a murder mystery and an American gangster play by an Englishman who's never been to America. The films are popular whether they're good, bad, or indifferent. One of the chief subjects of controversy among film critics and customers concerns Hollywood-made films of Britain at war. Some think that Hollywood shouldn't be expected to cling too closely to reality. Others say that if Hollywood tried to make films about things as real as London Under Fire and the Eagle Squadron, they should stick to the reality and skip the usual girl meets boy theme. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
And from our newsroom in New York, a news item from Chungking. The Flying Tigers are gone, but the Japs are still being clawed by American airmen in China. General Stilwell's headquarters announces that yesterday, U.S. pilots tore into a formation of 29 Jap planes over Hengyang airdrome. 9 Japs were shot down in a fierce battle, and another is believed to have crashed. No American pilots were lost, but 3 of our pursuit ships were destroyed, one of them on the ground while it was undergoing repairs. The air fight yesterday was the biggest in the China theater since the Flying Tigers were absorbed by the U.S. Army Air Force on the 4th of July. In the past 2 days, the Japs have lost 16 planes in attempts to raid the Hunan province airdrome. And from Vichy, the French freighter Mitidja was seized by a British submarine crew in the Mediterranean July 26 while en route with cereal, wine, and minerals from Algeria to Marseille. But she was freed by a French destroyer and naval planes and completed her voyage Thursday. These have been reports by Robert Magadoff from Moscow, Richard Harkness from Washington, Grant Parr in Cairo, and John McVane from London. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.